This is Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, our five-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference. All week, we bring you conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
Our proposition is that if you improve the healthcare culture, that will be felt by our patients on the other end.
And I think if you're from the majority society, you probably don't fully appreciate the power of role models.
What every child needs is at least one adult who's irrationally crazy about them.
She knows her body and she's empowered to be able to do the work of becoming a mother.
I'm Allison Bektesh. Today we look at diversity and inclusion as it pertains to healthcare and power to the patient. How can we even the playing field between doctor and patient? How do we make that person on an operating table a person? How do we give patients access to information and access to a health arena that is going to understand and respect who they are and what their background is? Coming up, we turn to Aspen Ideas Health speakers for the answers. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio. Stay tuned. Do doctors really know their patients? I mean, their name is on the clipboard, and they've probably checked off some symptoms on a list if they're not feeling well. But how does that translate to the doctor knowing what's going on with you? How does the doctor know if you are healthy? Of course, they have studied a lot to get where they are. They can infer a lot about those symptoms you've selected. They know a ton about anatomy and human bodies in general, even if they've never actually seen the inside of your body. Some know exactly how to cut you open if they did need a look through the inside, though, or take something out. Others know exactly how to load chemicals into your bloodstream, so when you're opened up, you don't even know what's going on. You feel no pain. So they're the experts, right? They must know better than you how to treat your body.
The power dynamics are like the healthcare provider knows it all, and the patient is just there to receive. But we want to create dialogue between the patient and the health worker.
We keep returning to Edna Masiwa because her life and her life's work intersect with all of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference tracks. She grew up with four sisters and a brother in rural Zimbabwe. Three of her sisters died of AIDS. Even though Masiwa was working in healthcare, she couldn't save them. And she couldn't even educate them. One sister stopped taking the antiretroviral drugs that were keeping her alive and relied instead on prayer. Masiwa alludes to being in a violent relationship in the past, but doesn't talk about it directly. Her early career included midwifery. She loves the process of bringing new life into the world. She now travels to rural communities, just like the one she grew up in, educating them about sexual and reproductive health, and basically teaching them how to be a patient.
For us, we wanted the patient to be well informed for them to be able to demand the services from the health centers. So our work focused mainly on pushing for self-value for patients, that when they get to the hospital, it's not like the health workers are doing them a favor.
That power dynamic is uncomfortable. If you don't have a story about a misdiagnosis from your doctor or having worries or symptoms brushed away, then you have a friend who does, and she's probably a woman.
I hear that sort of story all the time, especially from women. My friend actually made a term for it. She calls it clinical mansplaining, you know, where your thoughts and opinions about your own health are dismissed and you are talked over and told what is happening instead. I mean, I've heard that story a million times, and I've had a few experiences of that myself.
Esther Chu is among 50 female healthcare professionals who just this spring launched Time's Up Healthcare, a branch of the Time's Up movement, bringing to light sexual harassment and inequities within the workplace. She's also an associate professor for the Center of Research and Policy in Emergency Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University and an emergency room doctor.
So our proposition is that if you improve the healthcare culture, that improvement in culture will be felt by our patients on the other end. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, how can you provide high quality, safe, effective care if the workplace itself is not safe and is not respectful and is not dignified? We cannot treat patients well if our own house is not clean. And so I think there are more and more studies that provide an evidence base that when the workplace is more inclusive, and it can only be more inclusive with a workplace environment that is much, much better for women and for underrepresented minorities than it is now. But when the workplace is more inclusive, there are measurable benefits to our very diverse patient population. And if our bottom line in healthcare is good outcomes, we know that we get better outcomes with a workforce that is different than the one we have now.
The healthcare sector is slowly twisting the tables to try and balance out the scales. The term patient-centered care is rising in popularity. The idea is to go beyond those checkboxes and get a fuller picture of all the societal and environmental factors throughout a patient's history that weigh in on health metrics. Some we've already learned about in this series: access to care, stigmas, finances. Some we will explore more today. As a midwife, Jenny Joseph has made a career out of patient-centered care, long before the term was trendy.
Well, you know, if you think about it, we've had some little forays over the years, well, at least since I've been here, into what we call patient-centered care. And, you know, there's the, like, oh, this is a new and amazing thing, and let's all study it and see if we can implement it, and let's have conversations and conferences and see if this could possibly be so, as if that isn't an integral part of medicine, period. Right? And so, you know, midwifery is woman-centered because that's what it is. You can't have it any other way. It's patient-centered. So you remove the practitioner from the center and you put the patient in the middle. And in our case, the woman, her family, the person who is having this child is the center. And everything else needs to fall back and be, you know, work around her needs, concerns, fears, her input. She knows her body and she is empowered to be able to do the work of becoming a mother.
As a patient, Joseph had an entirely different experience.
And I've been in the United States for 30 years, but I had my son in England, in London, before I came here. So when I arrived, he was just 3 years old. And as a result of being in America and, you know, had a bit of an issue with gynecological problems, and I had them most of my adult life. But when I came, I think I fell victim very quickly to the system. And within a year of being in this country, I ended up with a full hysterectomy and actually ovaries removed at the age of 30. And as a medical professional, you can imagine, I thought I had some power and agency and understanding, but I was very quickly caught up and confused, ill-informed, and definitely disempowered in my own health and my own reproductive health. And so as a result of that, I now have one child and only one child.
Even as a healthcare practitioner, Joseph learned how little power a patient has when going up against the experts. For her patients, soon-to-be and recent mothers, she says the system has to change. Health outcomes need to be assessed by a whole bunch of other incomes as well. When doctors examine all factors in a patient's life, it tends to lessen blame and lead to better solutions.
We must stop blaming the women themselves for their own outcomes or suggesting that if they did this or that thing, they would do better, and recognize that this issue is deeper than that and needs to be addressed on those levels before we can really get to that transformation that I would hope that we will aim for. We could do this. We could transform birth outcomes and equity if we apply ourselves to it from those perspectives. But as long as we keep pretending that these women are bad and wrong and they shouldn't have this and they shouldn't do the other and it's their own fault if they don't pull themselves up by their bootstraps, then we will never get to the change that we seek.
Nasha Fitter is a mother of three. Her youngest, Amara, has a rare neurological condition known as FOXG1. Fitter started a research foundation to support studies that pertain to the syndrome. She's also the director of patient experience and data acquisition at Citizen, a company that is working to give patients power by giving them information. Their tagline reads, "We can do more," a direct and complete rejection of what patients often hear when they're out of treatment options.
Our goal is to help patients get second opinions faster. I think that is so critical in these types of conditions, for rare diseases especially, where your local doctor will likely have never heard of your condition, you know? So how can you send your information quickly, your brain MRI quickly, to a doctor, an institution that does know? And how can we have an insurance system that enables second opinions?
Ali Raja is the executive vice chairman in the Department of Emergency Medicine for Massachusetts General Hospital. He works every day to save patients' lives. He's also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and he knows the students he teaches will be much more capable of handling the same incidents that he faces in the future.
The thing that we often forget as physicians, as nurses, as healthcare providers in general, is that if we looked at the exact same people in our roles 50 years, 100 years ago, their level of knowledge compared to what we know now was laughable. Just like our level of knowledge compared to what will be known in another 50 or 100 years is equally laughable. And we have to stay humble because of that, because we will learn more as a society, as a population, but we don't know it all now.
Part of that increased knowledge comes from amazing new teaching technologies, virtual cadavers, and video game-like emergency scenarios. But part of it is because the student population is becoming more diverse and learning more about diversity. Don Warren, Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of North Dakota, says this isn't exactly altruistic, but it is effective.
It's wonderful that many medical schools are addressing diversity and inclusion, and much of that is related to accreditation requirements. So the LCME, that's the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, part of the criteria for an accredited medical school is to have a diversity plan. How are you approaching diversity and inclusion at the medical school levels? That includes diversity among students, faculty, and staff, and how are we being inclusive across diverse populations? So I see this movement occurring across the landscape of medical education, and I think a lot of it is because we recognize it's important, but in truth, a lot of it is also because we're not required to for accreditation.
The patient-doctor dynamic has to be one of trust. And we've seen the devastating consequences when that trust has been violated, and how hard it is to win back. Roger brought up the Tuskegee experiment, the unethical study conducted by the U.S. government who intentionally failed to treat cases of syphilis in African-American men.
Tuskegee is just the tip of the iceberg. There's been so many episodes of Black and African-American patients having things done to them by U.S. healthcare that there's a mistrust in that population of the healthcare system. Here in the city of Boston, we like to think that we've got some great hospitals, and we do, but there's only one of those hospitals that's really trusted by the local African-American population, and that's what used to be called Boston City, but it's now Boston Medical Center. It's an amazing world-class institution, but we've got Mass General, we've got Brigham, we've got Beth Israel. These are all great hospitals as well, but local patients don't feel comfortable coming to those other hospitals just because of the fact that they don't feel as though the physicians there look like them, whereas the physicians at Boston Medical Center do. And that's not right. We need to be changing the way that we act. We need to be changing the physicians who we hire, changing the medical students that we train, changing the college students that turn into medical students, that turn into our physicians.
One quick way to create patient-centered care is to look at who the caregiver is. Chu says, when we expand the diversity of care providers, it literally saves lives.
There are all these studies coming out that show that if you match patients to physicians with similar qualities, their survival is better. I mean, you know, not just they're happier with that interaction, they feel much more respected, but actually they're more likely to live. Or we actually eliminate some of the anticipated morbidity and mortality if we bring in physicians who look different than what we're used to seeing, who are able to connect with patients in a way that has not been possible when we had a very homogeneous physician population.
So how can we change who our practitioners are and put the power of health into the hands of individuals? Stay with us. are listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, exploring our global healthcare system through the research and insights of the speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute. Today, we're exploring the track, Power to the Patient. In journalism, there's a term for bigwig reporters on national networks who swoop into towns when something sensational happens, a fire, a shooting. It's dubbed helicopter journalism for the quick, one-hit nature of the stories, as the reporters fly out to the next thing once they get their shot. Of course, those stories lack the depth of what a town really is. They often resort to stereotypes, and they get a lot of things wrong, even little things like the name of a favorite restaurant in the town or the role of a community leader. Now imagine, as a local, in a town that is reeling from a hard hit, going to one of those helicopter journalists and asking them how they think you should rebuild. It's not so different from going to a doctor who doesn't understand your customs, your family setup, your access to getting things like medicine or physical rehab or therapy, measured in distance, time, finances, and stigma. How can they give you the best advice when they are just helicoptering into your body and your heart rate and whatever they're measuring when they use that device that looks inside of your ear? How can those 7 minutes matter? In his youth, emergency room Dr. Ali Raja wasn't even planning on going to college. Later, as a student at Rice University, he joined a paramedic team on campus. Most universities have this now, but it was among the first of its kind. The concept was, you need people responding to emergencies who know the community. And that can be as simple as knowing the layout of the community.
Nobody knows how to get around a college campus better than the students. And so when you have a student calling 911 from a college dorm room, sending in the Houston Fire Department's EMS team, they're not going to know how to get there quite as quickly as the student who's in the next dorm over and can run over with a bag.
Just like having a map of a campus in your head as you respond to an emergency, primary care doctors need to see that full, bird's eye view of a patient's life. This becomes all the more true as the demographics of our country change. Here's Warren.
Our students will be working with diverse populations. Over the next couple of decades, the majority of the U.S. population will be non-white. So whether we like it or not, or whether we're prepared for it or not, it's going to happen. So our medical students need to learn how to engage across different cultures and across different populations in order to be effective. So in order to be effective at communicating with patients, we have to be somewhat competent or at least cognizant of cultural differences related to medications, and also even looking at the social determinants of health. If we look at the human body simply as a machine that needs medication to get back into balance with blood sugar or blood pressure or what have you, then, you know, that's a very simple-minded approach. But the truth is, people live within a social context. They live within an economic context and a cultural context. And all of those determinants or influences on health have a huge impact on outcomes. So if we're not training our students in medical school and in residency to be cognizant of those social factors, then we're really doing them a disservice in the educational arena, and we're doing society a disservice by not recognizing these things. So I have seen some really good movement in medical education focused on diversity, inclusion, and health equity across multiple populations, and the understanding that we need to assess social determinants of health and not just treat the human body as a machine.
In order to diversify the medical field, you better have a diverse set of perspectives to take on the problem. For example, one element of a new Indigenous Health doctorate program that Warren is launching will be to help students get out of their cultural comfort zones and learn to play in the academic zone.
One of our challenges is that the cultural differences, just even focusing on leadership, when you go into academics or many modern professions, you have to be able to sell yourself. You have to be able to essentially brag about yourself. When I apply for a grant, you know, there's a whole biosketch section of the application, which is essentially 5 pages of bragging. And, you know, that's very culturally improper for many Indigenous populations. We're supposed to be humble. We're not supposed to be self-aggrandizing. But we have to learn how to do that if we're going to be successful in these fields. So there are ways to approach modern society and its need for self-aggrandizement and still be culturally relevant. So we're looking also at Indigenous leadership frameworks to address some of these cross-cultural challenges.
In the next episode, we'll talk a lot about role models and the benefit of intergenerational relationships. Here's a taste from Mark Friedman, author of How to Live Forever.
I started out focused on young people when I was in my 20s, and particularly on what young people needed to overcome some of the barriers of growing up in poverty and under other adverse circumstances. And there was a preponderance of research that pointed to the significance of caring adults. Yuri Bronfenbrenner, one of the great child psychologists of the last 50 years, Professor Cornell, who co-founded the Head Start program at the end of his life, was asked what he had learned from all of these decades of research on young people. And he said, what every child needs is at least one adult who's irrationally crazy about them. And the most important longitudinal study of children growing up in poverty, which was done on the Hawaiian island of Kauai by a University of California psychologist named Emmy Werner, who looked at these kids over 40 years growing up in extreme poverty, the ones who made it against the odds all had this presence of one or more caring adults who took them under wing. And so I think a question for me was if these kinds of connections, if these relationships, if these powerful human bonds are so important, why are so many young people struggling to get that kind of support?
We will get back to aging. But for now, knowing how important it is to have mentors helps us understand why young children need to see themselves reflected in the leadership roles around them. It was a defining moment for Warren when he met an American Indian doctor.
Well, I'm originally from Kyle, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And I was very fortunate to grow up in a family with a lot of traditional healers and medicine men. So I have several uncles who are traditional healers. So growing up, I was able to learn a lot about cultural approaches to health and wellness and holism. And that was just a part of my natural, normal world growing up. And as I was doing well in school, I was being encouraged to become a pre-med while I was in college. And at that time frame, I had never met an American Indian physician before. So I knew it wasn't illegal for an American Indian to become a doctor, but I had never met one before. So actually, when I was in college, I was able to identify an American Indian physician. My mom at the time was a nurse and worked for Indian Health Service, and she knew of one. And for me, that was really life-changing to actually meet an American Indian man who was a doctor. And I think if you're from the majority society, you probably don't fully appreciate the power of role models. If all of your principals and teachers and doctors and professionals that you've encountered are from your race or ethnicity, then anything seems possible. But if you never encounter someone from your cultural background in these roles, it might seem possible theoretically, but if you don't actually meet people doing these jobs, it makes an impact on whether or not we feel that it's feasible. So as I was doing well in school, meeting an American Indian physician while I was in college was a life-changing event for me, because then it really did seem possible to become a doctor. And in this process, I was actually worried that my uncles would be disappointed in me, kind of going to the dark side of medicine, so to speak, as opposed to going down the path of traditional Lakota medicine. But actually the opposite happened. They were very encouraging and said that this is a good idea. One of my uncles in particular, he's passed on since this time, unfortunately, but his name was Ray Takeswarbonnet. And he told me, I think this is a good idea, but if you become a doctor, never forget where you come from. Never forget who you are and what your responsibilities are as a Lakota man. And those responsibilities include giving back to our communities and not doing this work for personal benefit or personal gain, but there's a great responsibility with education and with the ability to make an impact. Then we are required to make that positive impact for people in our home communities who need it the most.
Let's get back to Nasha Fitter. Yes, she literally had to create her own research foundation, but that has resulted in a patient-centered atmosphere that is beginning to lead to the care needed for her daughter Amara, who has FOXG1 syndrome. It's also leading to new discoveries about gene therapies and indications that genetic disorders can be supported or even cured with drug therapies. Her story's not easy, but it's a pillar of what can happen when things go right.
There is something so powerful when patients themselves, as well as parents of patients, when you go through something like this, I think that I just think the purpose and passion it creates in you is so powerful. I'm really thankful, you know, even for the opportunity to go to Aspen Health and to share my story and things like that, is because of, I think there's a shifting focus to focus on the patient. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm really grateful that our healthcare industry is realizing that and is shifting the focus to the patient and caregivers of patients, because I think we live it, we're going through it, and you're never going to find an audience that is as passionate about solving disease. So I think that's something I'm really hopeful of, that I definitely witnessed this kind of shift towards patient-centric healthcare, personalized medicine. You know, you hear of all these terms, and so I'm really excited about that.
And it's a reminder of finding that person within the patient.
And even my daughter, I look at her like we're a team. She is the biggest blessing I've ever had in my whole life. And she is so happy. She's such a happy child. You know, she doesn't know anything's wrong with her, right? It's like the way society views her. So day-to-day life is great. You know, my other two children, they love taking care of their sister. And it's really us kind of figuring out with her, like, how to help her. So now we're trying to figure out a whole communication strategy of how do we help her communicate. You know, we're putting like pictures up in our house that she can go and touch. We're trying like a mixture of sign and of song, and like it's in some ways like really intellectually interesting to figure out like how do you help a human being develop. You could really see, like, okay, when your brain is not telling your body what to do, like, how much you have to struggle. And she watches us, so she knows, like, okay, this is where I need to get to. And I could literally see her struggling to try to do things. And she gets frustrated, and then she tries again. So, you know, life with her is, like, really even watching her human spirit. And then when she does do things, like, she's just very recently started to walk. I can't even explain to you what that was like for our family. So she is now kind of walking with her little, she's got these things on her legs she needs to wear, but she's walking around and she is so happy. So she'll like reach a destination that she was trying to reach and then she'll start clapping. Like life with her is actually a lot of fun. It's really fun. And she thinks the simplest things are so hysterical. So yeah, so day-to-day life like is absolutely, it's really quite joyous.
From patients' rights to diversity in the classroom, operating room, and the boardroom, the speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference are taking on these issues firsthand. You've been listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference. Join us each day this week at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2019 festival. Hear from leaders in medical research, mental health, patient care, and others on the forefront of health. You can also listen online at aspenpublicradio.org. The 2019 conference runs from June 20th through June 23rd. Join us all week as we dig into the ethics and values of our healthcare system, learn more about patient-centered care, take a frank look at mental health, and come to terms with aging. I'm Allison Bektesh. Thanks for listening to Your Health.